A tiny child, paddling in the dark waters of the burn, her snowy feet gleaming pearly white amid the shadows thrown by the green branches of the trees, her brown locks hanging in a profusion of luxuriant curls over her dimpled shoulders, and half veiling the azure blue eye and damask cheek, arrested our attention and formed as pretty a picture as one can well imagine, and the poet soul of my companion, drinking in the beauty of the scene, felt all the sweetness of life rushing over him, as he broke out in his quaint Scotch fashion, "Eh, thou winsome, wearsome, smiling creature, half formed of human, half of nature, thy soul gleams through thy every feature, this gladsome day, while life itself becomes thy teacher, thou prattling fay. Thy e'en, as blue as summer skies, reflect the joys of paradise, and glisten with a sweet surprise, that knows no guile, while angel praises o early rise, unbless the while. Thy bonny tresses veil thy face with such a winsome, modest grace, my spirit fain would leave its place and clasp thee close in and sweet, fervent pure embrace, like some rare owls. Thy snowy feet, like two fair pearls, gleam brightly neath the wave that whirls. The water o'er them softly purls. God loves thee best, and keeps thee mang the sweetest girls that heaven has blessed. In conveying a pure stream of crystal fluid through a muddy pipe, the liquid loses much of its clearness, and gathers sediment from the channel through which it passes. So, in striving to convey to your understanding a type of the outgushings of a noble spirit, it loses much of its transparency and becomes unsettled through the medium of earthly expression, and perchance distorted by the crude materiality it is sometimes obliged to pass through. Therefore, you are to take this as a symbol only of what I had the good fortune to enjoy. I learned in our rambles that the inhabitants of this smiling valley were not all the countrymen and women of Robert Burns, neither were they, when on earth, all of one belief or religion. They were of every race and clime. Some had been fierce denouncers of the truth, some earnest defenders of old theologic ideas and doctrines, others had had no religion, no faith either in God or man. But it was plain that all had suffered, had been weary, repentant, lonely, heart-sick, and homesick, and all had found a home, rest, action for their pent-up energies, development for their repressed powers, love, enjoyment, and peace beneath the ministrations of this good man and his gentle companion. I met with some of these happy people, conversed with them, after the manner of spirits, read the interior conditions of their souls, and found them all pure, loving, simple, intelligent, respecting man, adorning the divine in humanity, and recognizing God as the author of life, whose spirit was found in everything. How their spirits sent forth a halo of light, which, springing from their unbounded love and veneration for Robert Burns, settled about him like an atmosphere of glory. Well did I think highly of the good this man had accomplished, of the beauty of his life work, of the grandeur of his spirit, which, rising above adversity, rejecting the tempter, had outstripped by his example, by his endeavors, such a noble result as this, of the emancipation of souls from bondage. How many, few could tell, for his efforts have been unlimited, and the results of his labors are not confined to this valley, but are scattered far and wide in spirit life and on earth. What need has Robert Burns to return to earth and sing his songs through the lips of media? He does so rarely, and why? His spirit of love, of faith in God, of hope for human progress is so broad, so free and untrammeled, that it breathes itself out in a benediction of good over all humanity. It is manifested wherever a soul prays to be of use to itself and others. It inspires the weak with strength, and blesses the erring with a determination to redeem past errors. It is felt on earth and in spirit life, purifying, elevating, and regenerating. Is not this the loftiest poem, the sweetest song, the grandest tale that bard or prophet ever could have dreamed? Is it not the outworking, in lines of living glory, of the most sublime yet soulful plan of praise to God that spirit can conceive? Is it not the breathing, soul-quickening, revivifying poem of life that has outstripped from the inspirations and aspirations of a gifted, struggling soul once immortal, and which is the perfect culmination of all that has been dreamed of by that soul, manifesting itself in the fruition of a work of beauty, glory, and grandeur, a not of mechanical art, but of natural, quickened, sentient life. Could the mortal denouncers of Robert Burns witness his noble triumph of spirit over matter, his defeat of all sensual life, his wonderful efforts for the good of others, and his glorious soul, radiant with the light of truth, they would bow before him in abject poverty of spirit. One ever band of noble workers, his spirit flows out in love and forgiveness to all his foes, and in blessing to all humanity. Even in spirit life this soul remembers and loves his native home and haunts on earth. The rugged rocks and darkling streams, the gore-gemmed sod, and heather-crowned hills of Scotland, are dear to him still. We were seated upon a mossy bank, enjoying the loveliness of the scene, at the gleaming valley, dotted with its blooming gardens and snowy white habitations, the crystal stream murmuring at our feet, the birds chirping in the branches, the lofty mountains uprearing their crests but a little way before us, with the glorious sun, throwing a flood of golden splendor over all. Environed with these conditions, I could perceive the thoughts of my companion reverting to earthly scenes, and presently, with bosom heaving, and his great dark eyes glowing with the intensity of his emotions, he broke forth a, fair are thy smiling fields of green, O, vale, and sweet the flowers that gem thy emerald sod, thy zephyrs bring a spice in every gale, and man and nature here commune with God. Thy crystal waters flow in melody, thy birds make music through the waving trees, thy mountains, rising in their majesty, survey in grandeur all thy harmonies. But fair and sweet as thou, my spirit home, to this fond, loving, clinging heart of mine, are Scotia's fields, where once I loved to roam, and pluck the gown and the eglantine. Thy brooks are clear, but Scotia's burns are bonny, where once I paddled through the summer day, thy birds recall the times, not few but many, I've heard the mavis chant a tuneful A. And though thy mountains rise in mystic glory, they are not fairer to my spirit sight than Scotia's grim old crags and peaks so hoary, that brought my boyhood soul such dear delight. Aye, Scotia's lands to me are sweet and canny, as in the days I roamed her meadows fine, were loving fern, or gleesome, prattling ben ye those sweet, rare blessings of the old lang syne. As a ray of light, in passing through a pane of glass, may become broken or refracted, or as a straight staff placed in a vessel of water may present a misshapen appearance to the beholder, so in attempting to present to you the straight, symmetrical lines of thought, the golden rays of light, emanating from a poet's soul, they become broken and distorted in their passage through matter. But by these refracted rays you may be able to gain a faint comprehension of the glory of the soul in which they originated. And thus we passed our time, with great profit to myself, for, from the companionship of my friend, I gained a knowledge of the true beauty of the natural life of the spirit, and a larger conception of the grandeur of individualized life, when fulfilling its proper mission and expanding to its full capacity, even while drinking in the beauty of my surroundings. The harmony of the scene, quaffing the crystal drops or inspiring thought which filled the soul of my companion, and imbibing of that deep peace and gladness that imbued his entire being. In attempting to portray to you a tithe of the pleasure and profit that my spirit gained from this visit to Robert Burns, I have sought to give you an idea of the home and occupation of Scotland's immortalized son, whose songs and poems have enriched the literature of earth, and gladden the hearts of countless beings here and in the immortal world, but in doing so I have deeply realized that it is impossible for spirits to convey to mortals an adequate conception of life in the soul world as it really is. I am aware that I have said nothing in regard to the nearest relatives and friends of the poet, his brave, honest parents, those to whom he ever pays filial respect, and those also who receive fraternal sympathy and regard, his noble sons. That sweet, gentle daughter, the pet and blessing of his heart, whose early loss he mourned until his death, and last, but by no means least, his faithful, forgiving Jean, his counselor and guide to the end. Though I have not mentioned these, it is not that they are remote or separated from our poet. They are with him, as a cluster of stars gather around one brilliant, far-reaching center, and upon him they bestow that true spirit love and sympathy which he reciprocates in kind. But I have dwelt longest upon his connection with the beautiful ideal of his early life, for in her is centered the power to draw forth the noblest and purest aspirations of his soul. As a beacon light, a radiant star, her undefiled spirit, overflowing with the love that has blessed and enriched his being, has ever led him onward and upward over the ruts and pitfalls of sensual life until he has reached the heights of self-conquest and self-respect. In every sense, Mary Campbell has been the savior and sustainer of Robert Burns. Chapter 25. My spiritual work, it would ill become me to speak of my own efforts. There is so much to be done that the individual work of one alone is necessarily small, but if we strive to do good, with a will and a desire to benefit others, we cannot fail to be of use. And that you may know how it is a spirit labors in conjunction with mortals, I will briefly speak of my method of work, and give you a few instances of what I have done or have striven to do. I remember one circumstance well. At a gambling house in a large English city, I encountered a lad, about 18 years of age, whom I could see had been enticed there by the alluring visions of a fortune to be made, pictured to him by those well-versed in the secrets of sinful practices. He was a pale, delicate youth, with an intellectual cast of countenance, a well-bred air, and one evidently worthy of better things. I was attracted to him as he sat at the table, his whole mind concentrated upon the game he was playing. Suddenly, he pushed back his chair, rubbed his brow in a bewildered manner, and muttering, "Lost, everything lost. I counted on this chance to retrieve my luck, but it is no use, everything is against me," he seized his hat and fled from the place. I followed him, not knowing what he might do, and wishing to serve him if in my power. It was to his room that we went, the attic floor of a dingy lodging house in an obscure quarter of the city. I found that he was a student, striving to pay his way by literary labor, while gaining an education. His parents were poor, hard-working people, living back in the country, who had done all they could to assist their son. Flinging himself upon his humble bed, the youth gave himself up to dismal thoughts, the tenor of which was that he wished he was dead. His money was all gone, nothing left of all he had possessed but his books. Remunerative employment he found impossible to procure, and he knew not how to gain the means of livelihood. He could not apply to his friends, indeed, he would not have them know his situation for the world, and nothing remained but to put himself out of the way as soon as possible. In vain did I strive to turn his thoughts in another direction, in vain I pictured to his mind the horror and anguish of his friends, when they should learn what he had done. He was in no condition to be impressed by any influence that I could bring to bear upon him. Again he started up and left the house, I still accompanying him. He entered a small drugstore upon the corner, and, nodding nonchalantly to a young lad about his own age behind the counter, said, "Ned, I wish you'd trust me for a few pennies worth of arsenic. The rats are becoming such a bore up in my attic that I must do something, especially as the landlady pays no attention to my complaints." "Ayo, all right," responded the clerk, taking a bottle of white powder from the shelf, and proceeding to do up a small package from its contents. "Ayo, but you must be very careful of it. I suppose you know how to use it?" "Ayo, yes, thanks, I'll settle as soon as I can," replied the youth, and, taking the parcel, he hurried from the shop. I knew not what to do. I did not like to see that youth throw himself away in the manner he thought of doing, but how could I prevent it? In a moment more, a doctor's chaise drove up to the druggist store, and a portly, good-natured-looking gentleman, of about 45 years of age, alighted and entered the shop. "Ayo, Ned," said he, "prepare a bottle of cough mixture from this recipe," handing him the prescription, "and send it with a box of soothing powders to Mrs. Sims. She's very bad." "Ayo, all right, sir," replied the clerk, "but look here a minute. Harold H., who lives at number 8, was here a minute ago for arsenic. He said it was to kill rats. I let him have it, but somehow or other just now I feel nervous about it. Upon the doctor's entrance, I saw in an instant he was the one to be influenced in the right direction, and it was I who had produced the uneasiness in the clerk's mind, and impressed him to speak. "AOR," said the doctor, "I'll stop and see about this, and do you, Master Ned, have a care how you sell poisonous articles to whoever comes for them." He hurried from the store over to number 8, entered, and without ceremony passed up to the attic of the would-be suicide. I of course followed. We found the youth engaged in writing a letter, the package of poison close to his hand. It is needless for me to recount all that passed in that interview. Suffice it to say, that, by a few well-directed inquiries, that good men managed to learn the condition of the lad, and what had been its cause. He then proceeded to talk to him earnestly and firmly, yet kindly, of the sin he contemplated, of the agony of his mother upon hearing of the deed, and the anguish he would cause to all he loved. The young man broke down, wept bitterly, and promised he would live to be a better man. The physician furnished him with means sufficient for present necessities, promised him he would interest some of his influential friends in his behalf, and, when he left, carried the poison with him. The man kept his word, and through his influence Harold H. was placed in better circumstances, assisted in his efforts to gain an education, and lives today an ornament and useful member of society, and the pride of his parents and friends. More than once I have visited liquor saloons, hoping to draw some poor wretch away from the curse of rum and its allurements. I have not always succeeded, but at times have been more successful. On one of these occasions, a man in the prime of life, who was drinking copiously, and rapidly making himself worse than a beast, arrested my attention, but I could make no impression upon him. While making the effort, a street musician began playing a dancing tune. The musician, a young and delicate boy, accompanied by a still younger female child, who was the dancer, was one whom I could impress, which I did by making him cease the dancing tune, and begin that sweet, pathetic air of Payne's "Ao Home, Sweet Home." The little maid stopped her dancing, looked puzzled for a moment, when, catching the inspiration of the moment, she broke out in bird-like tones of sweetness, and sang the words of the song. I watched the effect upon the drinker. At first he did not seem to hear, but gradually a listening expression stole over his features, and at last his head sank upon his hands. Now was my time. I whispered to him of his mother, of his dear old childhood home, of his wife and child waiting anxiously for him even now, and of the dear one who had died and was calling to him from her heavenly abode. He, of course, never knew but what they were his own thoughts awakened by that tune. In part they were, but their power was intensified by spirit presence and aid. His spirit child was close by my side, anxious that her father should be drawn away from that place. From her I learned of her mother and invalid sister, who were living, and of whom I whispered in his ear. The music ceased, and, rising, the drinker passed from the place, unheeding the call of the barkeeper to stop and take another drink. I followed him home, saw his wife and lame daughter, and learned from the state of their minds that he had resisted all their pleadings to remain from the rum shop, and had even raised his hand threateningly to his child. He said nothing that night, but went quietly to bed. In the morning I was there. Softened and humbled in mind, the man sat looking out of the window. I went to his daughter, influenced her to call her father and talk to him, as she had never done before. It was the voice of the Spirit calling to him to look up higher, to pray for strength to resist temptation, and to strive to live a better life. Amid tears of contrition he promised, by the bedside of his invalid child, that man took the pledge, and so far it has been kept, and his family are content, while his spirit child is happy. On another occasion I was at a home, drawn by a spirit who solicited my assistance for her brother, who was addicted to drink. He, too, had a wife and family of little ones. At the time of my visit, he was possessed with an insane desire for liquor. I heard him promise his wife he would take none, but I had no faith in his word. He went out. I influenced his little girl to follow him. She was a child of about 8 years of age, and evidently stood in great fear of her father. We followed him, saw him enter a liquor saloon. I tried to induce her to enter, but she was afraid. "I'd like to follow Pa," she said, "but I don't dare, beat me." Still I urged, and at last, gathering firmness from the spirit world, she boldly entered the saloon, and addressed the barkeeper, who was mixing a drink for her father, thus, "Ayo, don't you give my father anything to drink, mister, it makes him crazy and sick, and everything is awful bad at home, and mother cries all the time." She was greeted with a loud laugh by the bystanders, but taking no heed, she seized her father's hand, saying, "Come, father, don't stay here, let's take a walk." "Ayo, yes, yes, little girl, let's take a walk, this is no place for you," he answered, and, winking to the barkeeper, and whispering, "He'll be back soon," he suffered the child to lead him away. I impressed the child to lead her father toward the water. The evening breeze was blowing cool and refreshing. "Father," said the child, "doesn't God see us now?" The man was evidently startled, but answered, "Yes, I suppose he does, if there is any God." "Oh, of course there's a God," pursued the child. "Don't the minister say so, and didn't grandma used to pray to him? Grandma's an angel now. Do you suppose she saw us in that horrid place, Papa?" "Oh, good heavens, I hope not," answered the man. "Come, you'd better go home." "Oh no, let's stay here a little while, it's cool here," went on the child. Her timidity vanished. "I guess grandma did see us, 'cause angels can go everywhere, you know. I don't believe she liked to see us there. I hope she'll ask God to keep you from going there anymore, 'cause it makes mama cry all the time." "Ayo, cry all the time, does she?" muttered the man. "Well, you must go home now." The cool breeze had lessened the fear in the man's veins. The child's prattle had driven the present thought of liquor away. Subdued and humbled, he led her home, and went out no more that night. In the morning his employer called for him to go to work, and he had no opportunity to visit the saloon. During the day I influenced one of those royal souls yet encased in flesh, who go about doing good, to visit that home, where he learned the state of affairs. He called again at tea time, saw the father and husband, and, by interesting himself in his pleasures and pursuits, won his heart, and induced the man to go with him to a temperance lecture. This was the beginning. Before the winter had set in, that man had signed the pledge, and was a member of a temperance organization. True, the victory was not easily won. There were many battles to fight with his appetite, and had it not been for noble souls immortal who stood by him, we could have done but little. As it was, the rum fiend was conquered. This is one method of my spirit work, allying myself with spirits, in the body and out, whose souls are zealously engaged in laboring for humanity. More has been accomplished than I care to tell. But very little has been done compared to what there is to do, and I am still laboring in cooperation with others, for the good time that is to come to all mankind. The above are only illustrations of one branch of my efforts to assist those in darkness. My labors have not all been expended in one direction, but I have endeavored to obey the commands laid upon me to go out and give the people light. In my travels I have come across mortals possessing, to a large degree, mediumistic power, which only needed to be awakened into life and activity to be of use to mankind. Often these parties were surrounded by conditions very unfavorable to the development of mediumship. In such cases I have endeavored to supply, in part, the favorable conditions from the spirit life, and have succeeded in unfolding powers that have proved a source of comfort to others. To illustrate, a number of years ago I was led to visit a spirit circle, the medium of which I found possessing rare powers and abilities, but which sadly needed culture. She was a young maiden, the child of poor parents, who were alike ignorant of the laws of mediumship, and the conditions necessary to their unfoldment. Of course, The manifestations of spirit presence were crude and variable, but finding I could assimilate my powers with those of that medium, I determined to take her in charge for a while, and see if I could not stimulate her spirit forces sufficiently to assist them into healthy growth and action. I did so, all unknown to herself and others, and, by directing her mind in a certain channel, succeeded in my task. I selected certain works for her perusal, a philosophical, moral, poetical, a and impressed her to read them, awakened in her mind a desire to write compositions and rhymes, influenced her to attend lectures and sermons, delivered by the loftiest intellects of the time, brought to her home parties who could assist her in the pursuit of knowledge, and thus, in spite of adverse conditions, she steadily advanced, until today she stands far ahead of her family in literary attainments, and is read and listened to with respect by many intelligent, thinking minds. The case of that medium presents a striking instance of what spirits can do in educating mortals, and in teaching them immortal truths, which they in turn must give forth to the multitude. Many times have I given my songs to the world through the lips of mortals. Sometimes they appeared crude and ill-expressed, limited, and warped by the undeveloped channels through which they flowed, but even then I rejoiced to know that they could bear comfort and hope to the sorrowing or the sinning souls they were destined to reach. At other times, my productions have caught a richness of expression, a beautiful and harmonious blending of sentiment and rhythm, from the depths of the mediumistic souls through whom they came that sent them ringing through the hearts of those who read or listened, until they seemed uplifted into the clear air of heaven. But my greatest joy has been in assisting the inner powers of others to grow and expand, leading them in their cravings for knowledge, and aiding their faltering steps up the rugged heights of life, in search of truth and right. When I find a soul who delights to take a sentiment and to express it clearly in rhyme, I encourage that spirit, no matter how crude or uncertain its efforts may be, for I perceived that the spirit is putting forth its powers, that, like the feelers of a plant, it is groping around to find a support that will bear it in its growth, and that, if it receives the strength and prop it needs, it will develop into a thing of blossoming beauty. But I do not encourage these souls to put forth their first feeble expressions to the world any more than I would advise the florist to place a tiny, fragile slip of plant life out in the full glare of a summer day. I watch them, and, by directing their thoughts into proper channels, and influencing them what to read in order to expand their minds, sometimes succeed in raising a rare stock, that favors the world with an abundance of rich and fragrant blossoms. A tilde broken barrow, and to do this we are teaching and directing those sensitive, intuitive souls who can catch the inspirations of the spheres, and sending them forth as teachers to the masses. In my wanderings to and fro as a spirit, I have become a cosmopolite, a citizen of the world, a claiming my home wherever I may be of use to humanity. But my efforts for the amelioration of suffering have not been confined to material life alone. I have met many distressed spirits who passed from the body, scarred and scathed by sin and passion, and who, in consequence, have been plunged in mental darkness. To them I have sought to bring hope and encouragement. The world beyond is thronged with those unhappy souls, and, though we cannot save them, as each one must work out his own salvation, yet we can aid and teach them to find the better way, and encourage them to persevere in their efforts to atone for the past by doing right. In my anxiety and eagerness to atone for my own past folly by helping others, I had taken no heed of the lapse of time, my whole soul having been wrapped in my work. I was at a séance in London one night, and had succeeded in gaining partial possession of a youth whom I wished to develop as a medium. While in this condition, unable to make my presence known, one of the party remarked, "We ought to have an exceptionably good séance tonight, as it is the last one of the year. Tomorrow brings us 1872. The words brought to me a vision of New Year's Eves spent in the past, and with it a longing for the sight of dear and familiar faces. I began to grow homesick and weary. 5 years previous I passed from the body, and most of the intervening time I had spent among strangers. With this thought in my mind, I found myself losing control of my subject, and in a moment I was away from material things, and out in the realm of spirit. Long before I had learned to travel by an effort of will as spirits do, and I could now upon desiring to be in any place instantly be there. Time and distance have no power over the ascended soul, and it can travel with the velocity of thought. In a moment I found myself in the magnificent garden I had before visited. All was blooming in richness and beauty. I entered the stately portals of a superb mansion, in the center of which a group of spirits were gathered in social converse. Judge of my delight in recognizing all who were dearest to me, a parents, kindred, and friends. As I entered I heard my mother say, "All day I have been calling Critchley,